Today, your top property questions answered. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Well, that is post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Well, I must tell you, my inbox is bulging at the moment, and I'm getting a lot of very similar questions from a lot of our audience. So I thought today what I would do is to distill down those questions and try and table some answers, because actually the same questions are coming up again and again, particularly in the current uncertain situation that we're facing. So today, let's walk through some of those questions, and also I'll try and give you some answers. And just to make it clearer, I thought what I would do is change my background, courtesy of my green screen, so that you can see which are questions and which are answers. Now, the first question I had was simply this: where will home prices go? And a number of people specifically mentioned Tim Lawless's recent comments that he thought prices were going to start recovering next year. And of course, a number of property spruikers are also on the same vein. So where will home prices go? Well, I think it's all about where interest rates are going to go, because it's very important to understand that movement in house prices is going to be determined by credit availability. And credit availability is in turn determined by where interest rates go. Now, at the moment, of course, interest rates have moved up. The RBA's moved the cash rate up six times since May. And the last one was 25 basis points. And they did say they're going to do some more. And the markets at the moment are saying they're going to take it up to about close to 4%. And then it will stay there through the whole of next year and into 2024. Now, the point there is, if that's true, and if the rates stay high, it means that one, borrowing power will continue to be reduced substantially. So if you go back to where we were before May, compared with now, the ability to be able to borrow up to the hilt is down by about 25 to 30%, depending on the particular circumstances. So that's the first point to understand. So if credit remains tight and interest rates high, I'm not sure that we're going to see a sudden reversal in the falls that we've seen in the housing sector. Second point to make is, although the RBA has announced six rate hikes, only the first three have actually percolated through so far into hitting households in their back pocket, as it were. Because when a bank gets the message from the RBA that cash rate's going up, the bank then has to communicate that, having made the decision. That communication process normally takes about a month. Then they have to make the changes in the systems, and then they have to run the monthly cycle. So it's 2 or 3 months. CBA says it's about 3 months, right? So that would mean that only about half of the increases that variable rate borrowers have come through yet. So you would expect to see that continuing. So that's sort of the first question. Now, if you have a view like CBA that cash rates aren't going to go up to more than 3%, and they might come down sort of early next year, whole different ballgame. The question is, how likely is that? Well, the market is saying that's not what they think at the moment. And bearing in mind, of course, the Federal Reserve is likely to raise 75 basis points in early November, bearing in mind that inflation is still very strong here in Australia as it is around the world, I'm sceptical that the RBA is going to stop lifting rates anytime soon. So that's the other side of the equation, is migration, because migration is starting to pick up now. And we are going to see migration, particularly in the new year, I think, start to pick up. And that's going to be an extra level of demand. And that could actually counterweigh some of the further falls in prices. The third point to bear in mind is that, of course, property investors who were very strong until quite recently have started to walk away now because there's no capital growth. And if they don't believe there's going to be capital growth and the costs of actually borrowing are going up, and that means that your property investments losing money on a cash flow basis without any capital appreciation, property investors will not be back. So there are so many, it depends, it's hard to know. My own central case is a fall of about 20% from top to bottom, and we're not there yet. And I think it's going to probably take a few more months than Tim thinks, but you know, by the middle of next year, if rates have actually stopped going up and if migration starts to pile in, we might start to see prices begin to settle. I have my doubts that we're going to see a significant further run-up. Remember that the run-up that we had through the COVID was completely artificial because they took the cash rate to 0.1%. And the government, through stimulation left, right and centre, you know, home builder and those sorts of things, they're not going to do that again. So even post the RBA stopping lifting rates, I don't think we're going to see interest rates dropping back to where they were, which is going to very much restrict the potential growth of prices into the medium term. The next question that I often get asked is the government likely to actually try and intervene in the market, perhaps to mitigate the price falls? And could we see various initiatives to try and turn it around? Well, there's one that I think is worth exploring. So the APRA buffer is 3%, right? And it's 3% above the current mortgage rate. Now, that's to give a bit of headroom. Of course, some people will now have their mortgage rates higher than that 3% buffer if they got them at the wrong time and when the rates were ultra low. Now, I guess there's an argument to say that APRA might say, well, actually, now that rates are, you know, 3 or 4 cash rate, which means the mortgage rate's, what, 6 or 7 probably percent, maybe we don't need 3%. Maybe we can take the buffer down. So APRA might do something. There is a possibility that we're going to see longer term rates and, you know, almost intergenerational mortgages. It's certainly available in other places. I personally am not that convinced that it helps. And of course, if you have a longer mortgage, you actually might pay a little less interest, but actually over the life of the mortgage, you pay a lot more. And as you extend the loan, the monthly payments don't go down actually that much, from 25 to 30 to 35. It goes down a bit, but not a lot. So I'm not sure there's a huge amount of headroom or appetite for that. But then you've got the other issue that housing affordability is way off the scale still, you know, and people need 6 or 7 or 8 times their income to be able to afford in many places. So depends, I guess, if prices come back, that might bring a bit more momentum. But at the moment, if you look at affordability, it's no better than it was 6 months ago because incomes aren't growing. The ratios are lower because of the 3% buffer on a higher amount, which means you can borrow less. So I'm not sure there's going to be a massive switch in sort of parameters that I can see at the moment. Now, the third question I often get is, why is there such a fixation on property in Australia? Because we are the world record holders of debt, of course, and so much of our assets are actually lodged against property. I think there's a bit of history here that people have seen very strong property price moves. Over the last 20, 25 years, prices have gone up. But you've got to understand why that was. They deregulated the financial system. They took interest rates down to the ultra-low level, and they increased the income multiples so that basically you could borrow a lot more. Now, all of those levers, you know, run out of smoke eventually. And so we've had a generation or two who actually believe that property is a surefire bet. You know, my surveys still say that a lot of people think property prices religiously double every 7 years, right? So property values. Now, actually, factually, that isn't necessarily true. It depends where you look, because different properties in different areas function very differently. But we do have that. The other point is, of course, that there are some very generous tax breaks for property investors, and particularly on negative gearing and those sorts of things. And that's another reason. We have 33% of all mortgages are actually for investment purposes. That's double what it is in the UK. And it's interesting, the Bank of England got really twitchy when it came up to 16% of total mortgage lending for investors. They throttled it back. I haven't done that here, although they did make some minor changes recently to some of the expenses that you could write off. So we've still got very favourable tax structures for investment purposes. I have a feeling, though, that this real spike that we've seen over the last 20 to 30 years, I think it's a bubble, may not actually replicate itself. And therefore, we might start to see a bit of an alternative story ahead. The other point to make is, if you go back 20, 30 years, 1/3 of bank lending was for mortgage purposes, 2/3 was for business purposes. That's been reversed. So now the banks are predominantly mega building societies, right? So 66, 67% of their lending goes to mortgages. Then they lend a bit more to the construction sector. So a lot of it is actually around construction. Much less is actually available to businesses. And I see a lot of business in my survey who just cannot get the finance they need to help grow their businesses. So we have a really warped financial system because of this fixation on the credit for houses and units. And we also have people who in turn have got used now to paying a lot more than they did in terms of multiples and size of mortgages and those sorts of things. So we've got this sort of vicious circle. And it was virtuous for a time, but I have a feeling that the spiral could work the other way. And that's why some of the things I'm concerned about are some of the risks in the system that we've got now. Now, another question that comes up very often is, what should be done from a policy perspective? Are there things that should be done or could be done to help solve the property affordability problem? Well, I think there are some sort of stop doing stuff and start doing stuff. So it's interesting, the Productivity Commission came out the other week and said, oi, all these first owner grants that you've been throwing around the place, both federally and state, stop it. Because all you're doing is just driving properties higher. You're driving prices higher for those people who were already at some stage going to be able to afford to get into the property. What you should be doing is redirecting all of that funding, and it's about $3 to $4 billion over recent years for first owner grants. That should have been put back into the rental sector to help people who have real housing issues, and it's not just affordability. They've got no access to housing. And they sort of made the point that, well, really, housing, you know, it should be a social right. It shouldn't be just based on whether you can afford it or not. So that's, I think, an interesting observation about putting some supports in place, particularly to help those who are unable to get any sort of accommodation. The second is, over the last 30 years, the public sector investment in housing has gone through the floor. You know, most of it just been chucked across to the private sector, to property investors. And basically, the governments have said, we'll outsource all of that to property investors and we'll give them a bit of a tax break and she'll be right. But unfortunately, as you say, the total pool of properties for rent is dropping. The average rental increase for new rents at the moment are somewhere between 10 and 20%, depending on where you look. So people are finding huge amounts of difficulty being able to afford to rent anywhere, if you can find anywhere. And so the whole system is broken. I think we have to talk sensibly about social housing. And I think there's a very important role of government, both state and federal, to think about how we actually deal with social housing. And then I guess the third question is there an opportunity to change the formulation around the way that property investors work so that effectively we can perhaps encourage a few more people to want to put their properties back into the system? Because the other thing that we've seen is a lot of people have actually switched to Airbnb. So rather than actually long-term leases for people so they can go and live in the house, you know, property investors are saying, well, I'll just let my property out, you know, peak season, few days a year. It's a lower impact on the property, so it doesn't wear out as much. I get, you know, a significantly higher return. So I think, hard to know, but I reckon there's 350,000 to 400,000 Airbnb properties across the country. I think we need to look at that, because I actually have a real problem with that approach, bearing in mind that we have a housing problem, particularly rental ones. So I will be looking at some of the Airbnbs. We need to get better information on who are actually running Airbnb properties. They should be, I think, taxed as commercial businesses rather than actually not, because at the moment, a lot of people don't declare perhaps what they should declare. So I think those are some of the policy issues. I think the other factor we've got to come to is that we can't go on extending the income multiples for households just so they can get in the property market. So we have to, you know, actually, I think property values going back would be quite helpful, because it would help people to perhaps afford a little more. At the moment, many people are having to put up 40, 45, or even 50% of their disposable income just to get a place to live. And that's really not good policy, because it's sucking a lot of action out of the rest of the economy. So, you know, there's a few things there, but this is a really intractable problem. It's a structural problem. It's not just going to go away on its own. We need action at the federal and the state level, I think, in a coordinated fashion. And we can't just say it's a supply problem, because it's not. There's more than a million vacant properties across the country at the moment, you know, and maybe they're not in the right place or the right type of property. But it's a much more structural issue, and it's a social issue, and it's an economic issue that we need to get to the bottom of. Now, another question that comes up often is the fixed rate problem. We know about 25% of all mortgages are currently on fixed rates, and we know that there are going to be big rate rises ahead. So what does it mean, and what are the consequences? It's going to be a pretty shocking. It's a bit like the adjustable rate loan problem that they had in the US at the start of the global financial crisis, where effectively people were on low rates and then they had to refinance to a higher rate and they were unable to do that. Now, there is, as you say, about 25% of mortgages at the moment on a fixed rate. The peak actually will be in the first half of next year, because a lot of people were on 2 or 3 fixed rates and they're coming. And in some cases, they're going to go from, as you say, under 2% to maybe 5 or 6 or maybe even 7. The other point is, of course, banks will be obliged to apply the current underwriting standards to those new loans, which means a 3% buffer on the current mortgage rate. So it'll be very interesting to see whether the people who are on those fixed rates now can afford to get now the next mortgage, or whether in fact they will fall foul of the underwriting standards, and what will they do then? So I'm expecting to see some people being forced to sell because of that, or at very least, if you can get a mortgage, and you know the rule of thumb is for a 30-year mortgage, every 1% on interest rate up over 30 years is equivalent to a 15% monthly increase in the payment. So that means that you could be looking at a 50% uplift in your payment. Plus, of course, you're probably now not going to be on an interest only, but principal interest. So that could be another issue too for many people. So I think this is a really big problem. And that's another reason why I would argue that there might be downward pressure rather than upward pressure on prices next year. Now, a number of people ask me whether the RBA could actually bring rates down. And of course, they refer to the 25 basis point rise last time around. Whereas, for example, in New Zealand, it was 50 basis points. Is the RBA going to change direction? I don't think the Reserve Bank can bring down rates while inflation is high. So it's very clear that Lowe is saying that dealing with inflation is the most critical thing on their agenda. And look, central banks around the world are saying that. And that's because if you have high inflation, everybody loses because the value of your savings go down. You end up chasing your own tail, just trying to cover your expenditures. RBA is going to have to continue to lift rates until inflation gets back within its target band. Now, the rate at which they do it might be slower than in some other parts of the world, but they can't turn around and say, oh, I'm going to cut rates. Because if they do that and inflation is still not conquered, it'll go through the roof. And the experience of the 70s and the 80s was that once inflation got embedded and ingrained, it destroyed economies, destroyed livelihoods, and lifted unemployment rates. So I'm afraid the RBA has no choice to execute what it's currently doing. And by the way, it's also following the Fed and the RBNZ in New Zealand and the Bank of England and even the ECB. They're all doing it. So if you move too far out of step and if you start taking interest rates lower, that's then going to slay the exchange rate. The exchange rate's currently sitting at 62 to the US, right? It was at 70-something last year. That's a significant depreciation. And the problem there is you then start importing more inflation because, of course, we buy oil in US dollars, which means we're going to be paying a lot more for oil because of the local exchange rate differential. So if they let the interest rates stay too low relative to international peers, it's just going to put more inflationary pressure on, which means it comes back to my further argument. They've got to conquer inflation. So I don't think they can turn that around. And I know that there'll be, in fact, Wayne Byres the other day giving evidence towards Parliament said he knows that some people are going to have problems. And Phil Lowe's pretty much said the same. And their generic conversation about lots of people got boppers. Well, some do, absolutely, some do, but a lot don't. And unfortunately, what I'm seeing in my numbers is that there's about 30% who have no buffers at all, and already living hand to mouth when it comes to servicing their mortgages. There's another third that are sort of getting to the point where they're going to have to actually think quite differently about how they spend. There's a third that are absolutely fine and would be fine if rates go up to sort of 7, 8, 9%. So it's very variable across the household cohorts. And I sometimes feel that the RBA and APRA talk too generically about what's going on rather than looking at specific households. Unfortunately, many specific households are already finding it quite tough. Very important question that people ask also is how accurate is the CPI baseline? Will the change to monthly reporting help? And how lagged is the data? So is there a risk of the RBA overshooting? Well, they've just changed the CPI, so it now is reported monthly. So it's interesting because we have the first read, I think, was it 2 weeks ago? Time flies when you're enjoying yourself. So they basically now are reporting it every month, and then they do the quarterly, which is sort of a slightly revised version. Interestingly, the first monthly read, it showed that core inflation was still higher. And they also highlighted the fact that the rental sector was only growing at about 2%, which, of course, is because they're looking at all rents, including those that haven't yet been reset, right? Whereas new rents are somewhere between 10 and 20% higher, depending on where you look. So there's a lot more pressure coming through from the rental sector, I think. And we're also seeing more embedded inflation in the latest numbers around some of the service sectors. And that was despite the fact that the cost of petroleum dropped dramatically from its peaks earlier on. That wasn't enough to offset the other inflationary costs. So we now have monthly CPI, which, as you say, should help the bank. But it's interesting because some time ago, Phil Lowe said it can take 12 to 18 months for the impacts of monetary policy to really be transparent in the economy. So you're dead right. They're still flying blind. And, of course, many economists are saying, well, they're going to overshoot. They're going to put rates up too high and we're going to get into a recession. And then they'll have to sort of cut rates again. So that's sort of the story that many people have. But it's clear to me that they have to deal with inflation. And until inflation is below the 3%, the 2 to 3% target, they won't be able to reverse. By far, one of the most critical questions that I get is, what should households be doing now, particularly those with a mortgage, or indeed perhaps those thinking about getting a mortgage? The first is that many households actually don't know the mortgage rate they're on, and many people are still paying more than what they should be paying, simply because they haven't shopped around. So the first thing is, go find out what your mortgage rate is, and then go to some of the comparison sites and see whether it's the best rate that's available to you today. Because quite a few households that I've come across, they've been able to reduce their mortgage rate by 100 basis points, 1%, and that's a big one. Second one is that many households don't actually understand their cash flows, what's coming in, what's going out each month. But half of households have some sense of that, the other half don't. So it's very important to build a cash flow. And in fact, the Money Smart website at ASIC has a very useful tool that allows you to put money in. There are other apps that can do that. But understand your cash flow. And then, very importantly, prioritize those money going out particularly. You know, are you paying the important things versus the urgent things? Are you, you know, spending money on the things that you don't really need to spend money on? Because there's a prioritization question. And I keep coming back to things like, how many streaming services do you have, and how big is your mobile phone plan? Does it need to be? You know, there are things that you can do. Third is, of course, that it may well be that you can refinance as well. And, you know, there's a lot of people still refinancing and being able to mess with that. Now, of course, the problem there is if you're not careful, you can end up with a longer loan, and that superficially means you're paying less, but actually you're paying more in terms of interest. So that doesn't always, you know, work, but it might get you through. I think the final point to say is that there are sometimes people whose financial system, financial circumstances have changed and won't change back. And they're the ones that need to make some decisions early rather than later, in my view, because there's still at the moment equity in most of the properties, because properties haven't dropped that much yet. If you leave it and, in 6 to 9 months later, price has dropped another 15%, you might actually not have any equity left in the place. You might still owe the bank money even if you paid the mortgage off. So sometimes, once you've done the sort of the hard thinking, taking an early decision to sell may not be as horrendous as some of the other alternatives. Or at least talk to your lender, because they do have hardship arrangements and schemes, and explain the situation to them. Don't put your head in the sand. And don't just assume she'll be right. Remember that real wages is still going backwards, because inflation's 6-7%, right? Wages aren't growing anything like that. So you are losing every week, every month, and that's a problem. The other point to make is that people don't like having these conversations and sometimes just don't want to deal with it, right? Now, if you go back to the early 2000s, people got out of jail because wages growth really started to take off, and they actually got themselves out of deep water because of wages growth going much faster than inflation. There's no chance of that. Even the RBA is saying real wages growth will be nothing to write home about till 2024, 2025. So there's no short-term wages fix here, unless maybe you can switch jobs and, you know, work more hours and those sorts of things. And by the way, in my surveys, we are seeing more people doing second jobs, working more hours to try and bring more in, to try and cover the costs, to chase the mortgage rate up. So that's sort of another factor. So it's a really complicated situation, but don't ignore it is what I'd say. Now, one of the questions I get often is, how do we do our modelling and how our surveys flow into the way we actually do our postcode analytics? We survey households on an ongoing basis, and that allows us to then look at a granular level about what's going on. Let me show you, I'll give you, here's an example, right? This is postcode 4000, which is, you know, right in the centre of Brisbane, right? And this is based on my data. So it's also marrying up census data as well. So, for example, in this postcode, there's about 9,200 households, right? 13% own their property outright, 18% borrow, 68% rent. So that's quite a high rental proportion, right? Now, of those borrowing, not that many are in mortgage stress in this particular postcode, but a lot in rental stress are actually finding it quite difficult at the moment. So stress levels are quite high. Then what I do is I model where prices may go. And I've got three scenarios, the best, base, and worst case. So the best case is that rates don't get very high and inflation comes off. That will be the Tim Lawless scenario, I think. The base case would be that we actually get recessions in the UK, the US, and elsewhere, but not here. The worst case is we get a recession here in Australia as well. And I have those scenarios for houses and units, right? But it's interesting, then looking at what proportion of houses, so there's 8% that are houses, 87% are units, and there's a few others like living over shops and things. And then you've got the gross investment yields, so that's quite good, 5.3% gross investment yield, but the net investment yield is only 1.9%, so that's quite low. But believe me, many other investors' segments in other places are actually even a lot lower. And then if you look up here, I've got the taxable income from the ATO and the household census, and I've worked out what the monthly disposable income. So a typical household in this postcode has a monthly disposable of $6,600, right? And around one-third of their monthly disposable income is going on to pay the mortgage at the moment, on average, $2,239, right? And about one-third dip also going on the renting. Now, those are big numbers, one-third, right? And so I use this data to be able to then actually figure out what it really means in terms of specific households. Now, that's one right in the centre. Okay, so this is Albany Creek, and in the Hills District of Queensland at the SA3 level. Okay, now this one, another 9,000, right? 32% own outright, but 51% are borrowing. So that's much higher proportion of people actually with a mortgage. Only 16% renting. But look at this. 43% of those who are borrowing are actually in mortgage stress. Now that's on a cash flow basis. So they've got more money going out than money coming in each month. And 66% of renters have a problem, right? And then you can look at the scenarios. Well, you know, the best case scenarios, you might see houses rise by about 4% over the next 3 years. The base case down close to 20%. The worst case, even worse than that. 86% of houses here in this particular postcode, a very small number of units. And interestingly, not many vacant properties. In census night, 3.9% were vacant, which is 383. In a couple of the other postcodes, it's much, much higher. But look at the gross investment yield, 4.6%. Not bad. Net investment yield, 1.4%. That's not flash because, you know, we think inflation's running at, what, 4, 5, 6%. You're not making much in terms of returns. Then if you look at the taxable income, ATO says per individual 92,000. The household census says 127,000. That translates to a disposable monthly income of around $7,200. But the average mortgage repayment's about $2,600, which requires 36% of monthly disposable income. For a renter, it's a bit less at about 32.5%. So you can sort of see, when you start going into the granularity that I'm going into here, that you can see there's some really interesting things going on. And you start to see a correlation then between disposable income, mortgage stress, all those things. And the problem is I've been tracking this for quite some time. So effectively, it does get worse. It's got a lot worse over recent times. I've given you information with just a typical couple of codes. I have that for pretty much every postcode across the country. But then I map it, right? And here's an example of mortgage stress in and around Brisbane. And the way to read this is that the map goes sort of red and orange at the top. This is the count of households in mortgage stress. And as you go down to blue, it's the bottom. And you can see in and around Brisbane, well, there's a few areas like sort of Camp Hill, right? And is it Kurana down? And then down towards Ipswich. So there are some issues. Now, if you pull out and sort of get a bit of a sort of a wider view, you can start to see that there are some hotspots around Brisbane where, in fact, there are a few issues. And in fact, you know, as you pull out, you start to see, for example, if you go down to the Gold Coast, there's a fair degree of mortgage stress in and around the Gold Coast, for example, right? And, you know, if I pull out further, you can look at places like Toowoomba or the Sunshine Coast. But I won't. I'll just go up to the Sunshine Coast because I can. So this is a national map that I maintain that just shows you the distribution. So this is the Sunshine Coast here, right? And what's fascinating about this is that this then starts to give you some intelligence about where property prices are more likely to fall, because there's a high correlation between price falls and high levels of mortgage stress, which, if you think about it, makes sense, because it means that people are less able to afford to make those repayments. They might have to actually put the property in the market. So there's a sort of quite interesting correlation. When I run my scenarios, one of the elements that I use, as well as things like interest rates and migration, is actually stress. So that's how the system works. The next question I'm going to answer today is, why is granularity so important? Because, of course, there are many high-level indices out there, but do they actually really tell you very much at all? Why do I focus so much on going into the detail? When you look at property, you have to go granular, right? You cannot look at generic averages or, you know, indices for Brisbane or Sydney or whatever, right? It's completely meaningless. You need to get granular to understand what's going on. And what I tried to do with those examples was demonstrate how when you go down local, you can start to see quite different things. And, you know, I run a particular service called my one-to-one service, where I can actually help somebody look at a particular suburb and use some of my data to help them and get them to understand what's really going on in that suburb. And there, you know, there are still opportunities. There are still some first-time buyers saying, well, you know, maybe this is a good opportunity for me personally because I want to buy. I'm not too worried if I lose a little bit of capital in the short term, because longer term, you know, it's going to go up. And this can help them sort of spot where might be a good place to look. We've also got some property investors trying to work out whether they should hold the property, whether they should buy more property. So it sort of gets into quite a granular discussion. And in fact, one of my one-on-one conversation, I also pull the data from the latest property portals to show you what's around and look at things like flood maps, which is something which a lot of people don't look at, crime maps, the development plan, all of those things, because you start then and flood, particularly flood plan, flood related issues, very important. Just to get a flavour of what's going on. So that's what I do. And I have quite a few of these conversations at the moment, because there are a lot of people confused about the market, you know. And like I said, they just read the newspaper and it says everything's fine or everything's falling or, you know. No. You've got to grow granular to really understand. And units and houses are doing different things. Different locations are doing different things. And that's what I sort of specialise in. Now, here are my key takeouts based on the responses I've had from all the questions in recent times. Three quick things. The first is, nobody knows ultimately where rates are going to go, right? If we get, you know, a broader European war, all bets are off. If we get significant recessions starting to appear, including in Australia, all bets are off. On the other hand, if inflation remains stubbornly high, rates will go higher, and that means that the mortgage rate will go higher too. So nobody knows. And you know, you can talk to different people and you can get different points of view. That's why I run different scenarios. You need to play the counterfactual at the moment. What if? You know, what if my income doesn't go up? You know, what if prices... So you got to do the thinking. And the final point, just to reemphasize what I said, and go granular. Don't just take the generic... Oh, Brisbane prices have only dropped 3% or 6%, whatever it is, you know. Look at it as a detailed level. Units and houses are doing different things. Different types of property are doing different things at different time frames. And therefore, the generic conversations about property, I think, are very unhelpful. It's a bit like looking at the ASX and say, well, the ASX today went down 1%, right? But if you look at the individual components within the ASX and different shares, some went up, some went down, right? The index tells you very little. So go granular. So I guess that's the key message. And the final point to make is don't panic. Property cycles come and go. And I've lived through about four cycles, up and down, up and down, up and down, right? It's never as bad once you've been through it than it appears to be in the middle of it. So I always say to people, don't panic. And sometimes not doing something is still a strategy. And the final question I'm going to tackle today is, how do I find out more information about your one-to-one service? You mention it often, but I can't find out how to get details. Well, if they go to my website at digitalfinanceanalytics.com, go to the blog, and on the blog, you can see the one-to-one service there, or you can just contact me via the blog directly, send me a message and say I'm interested, send me some more details, and I'm happy to share that. I'm booking about 3 to 5 weeks ahead because I got so many people saying, help, what's going on? So there you are. I hope you found that useful. And I just want to thank you for all your questions and comments. Look, I do read them all, even if I don't respond directly to you. And if you have further questions that you'd like help with, feel free to send me a message via the DFA blog. You can use the chat feature on my blog at digitalfinanceanalytics.com/blog. And from there, you can send a message directly into my inbox, which I will respond to. So, well, I'll be back with more information in another show soon. And in fact, on Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Sydney time, I'll be joined by mortgage broker Chris Bates. And we'll be discussing specifically what's going on in and around the Sydney market. And keep a lookout for my next Andy Spruik video, which will be focusing in on Canberra, because there are some big moves happening there at the moment. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.